We present My Word. A panel game devised by Terry Tran and Edward J. Mason. And here to introduce the teams is John Julius Norwich.
Thank you very much. Our teams for this week are Dennis Powell, Antonia Fraser, Frank Muir, and Dennis Norden. And so off we go straight into the first round, which, as usual, probes their vocabulary. For 2 marks, Frank, what is the meaning of the word cinerarium?
Is it Roman? Is it Latin for a house of ill repute?
Non.
So
it's a singular flower.
It's not even a singular flower.
Is it an underwater cinema? Is it? Cinerarium. How do you spell it?
Full marks for trying, but actually no marks for getting the correct answer. It is a recess in which an urnful of cremated ashes is kept. Antonia, the meaning, please, of a bingle.
A bingle?
A bingle.
Well, if there's any justice, and I'm not quite sure whether there is, as a dingle means a dell, a bingle ought to mean a bell. How is that? Is there any justice?
Alas, none. No justice.
Der bingle was one of the affectionate terms by which Bing Crosby was known.
It was, but this is a bingle, not even ein bingle.
It's a bangle squashed flat.
I'll tell you what it is. It's a cross between a bob and a shingle, a term I take from international coiffure. Dillis, what is an antigropelos? Antigropelos.
Greek.
It's Greek.
Yeah. All right, it's Greek.
It's antigropelos. It's a Puritanical Greek sect which was against groping.
I withhold one bonus mark for the anti-groping Greek thing. It's so much better than the real answer, which is in fact waterproof leggings. Yes. Infundibular.
Wait a minute. Is that a word I would have learned in chemistry a lesson?
Indirectly, you might have, I suppose, but it would be fairly indirect.
Well, it would be, because I didn't actually learn anything during chemistry lessons. It's one of those things that didn't stay with me at all, except if you dropped a farthing in some kind of acid, it came out looking like a golden sovereign. Now, thousands of people all over the world are saying, Dad, what's a farthing? Is it? No, that's about as far as I can go. Yeah. It sounds Latinish.
Well, Latinish is what it is. I'll tell you what it is. It simply means funnel-shaped.
Ah, yes, it would be. Then it would be a vessel.
So you could perhaps, in your case, have a sort of an infundibular piece of litmus paper or something like that. But I can't at last give you any marks for it. However, before we go into round two, Frank and Dennis here, as usual, are the quotations you were given for the last round. Frank, your quotation is, I am monarch of all I survey. And Dennis, yours is, the stars and stripes forever. And now we go into a round of unlikely connections. For 2 marks, Frank, what is the connection or the association between the following pairs of names or words? Major Wingfield and Wimbledon.
Ah, yes. Major Wingfield invented a portable tennis court. In other words, he took real tennis away from the court, the built, manufactured court room, as it were, and said, let's do it on grass with lines and things. And therefore you could play it anywhere. And they played it at Wimbledon because
because their name was the Croquet Club and it wasn't long enough. So they sort of made it the Croquet and Lawn Tennis Club. It would carry a bit more class.
Well done. It was Major Wingfield who was the first person who said, let's do it on the grass. In 1874, he patented a game which was based, as you rightly say, upon real tennis that could be played out of doors. His game was adapted and refined by the All England Croquet Club at Wimbledon. Two marks. Antonia. Enoch Arden and William Crichton.
Well, Enoch Arden came back from the dead, didn't he, and gave everybody good fright. Isn't that Enoch Arden?
Mm. The world has never seen a costlier funeral.
Yes. Mm. William Crichton, I don't know about quite so much, but I assume he either was a undertaker or did likewise, came back and gave a whole lot of other people a good fright.
Would he be the admirable?
Ah, now you're getting somewhere. He was extremely admirable.
You mean lost the butler lost on the desert island?
The butler lost on the desert island is exactly who he was.
Well, then...
But what's his link with Enoch Arden?
Well, they also came back, didn't they? They came back from their desert island.
Well, they were both shipwrecked. And how else, anyway, do you get to a desert island? You're perfectly right. I think I'll give you two marks for it. The actual answer is they were both shipwrecked, but desert islands are the sort of places that only shipwrecked people get to, aren't they? So, two marks you get. Dillis. The connection, please, between a newt and an orange.
They're both drunk, except an orange.
Mm. Well, I can tell one from the other. A newt. One's a fruit, and the other's not quite a fish. They both sort of originated in South America or something like that.
Are they both apples?
Neither, actually.
Neither are apples.
No.
No.
I don't
orange
think you're going to get it.
Orange
I don't think you're going to get it. I'll tell you what the answer is. It's quite interesting. Both words have changed from their original spelling because of an initial letter N.
Transferred
a newt was originally called an ute.
Oh, yeah.
Whereas an orange was originally called a norange.
An apron.
And in most languages, in fact, except English and French, it still is. It still begins with an N and then sounds more or less like narange or narange or something like that afterwards. Dennis, see if you can do this one. The link, please, between Oliver Cromwell and Tom Sawyer.
Well, I have sitting beside me Oliver Cromwell's press relations officer.
but I never worked
and
with Tom Sawyer.
Tom Sawyer. Well, you know all about Oliver Cromwell. Let's see, what do I know about Tom Sawyer? Did Oliver Cromwell have an Aunt Polly?
Well, I suppose...
Poll, that's Paul. Right. Poll, he was known... Wasn't he known as...
Well, Old Noll, actually.
Old Noll, that's right. Yes, that was... Oliver Goldsmith was... Was that... Was he Paul?
He talked like Paul Poll.
Talked like Paul Poll.
Did Tom Sawyer have a wart?
That's it, a wart. Yes, wart.
Warts is, in fact, the right answer. Oliver Cromwell had them on his face. Tom Sawyer had them on his hands. I think I will give a little bonus mark to Frank for getting warts. But alas, I don't think I can give them to you for Knowles or... Now, a round of differences. For two marks, what is the difference in meaning between the following two words? Frank, rare and scarce.
Very little difference. Scarce means... There aren't many of them about. They're difficult to find. They are... Rare means there aren't many of them about. But rare does it not has... The word implies a quality, which the word scarce doesn't. In other words, a rare book is a book which is valuable because it's scarce.
I think it's much, much easier than that. Rare is used of things that are infrequent at all times, but also of things that have superior qualities. Scarce are things that are only temporarily infrequent. If something is rare, it's rare always. It's a rare book, or it's a rare bird, and it's rare for keeps. It's really the difference between something temporary and something permanent. Antonia, the difference, please, between to perturb and to disturb.
To disturb If you disturbed me too much on this programme, I should leap over the platform. If you perturbed me, I would burst into floods of tears.
What is actually the difference in the meaning of the words rather than your reaction to them?
Well, one is that I was attempting to illustrate. I thought it would make it easier for you to understand.
Give it
my
examples.
And easier for me. Interior and exterior.
Interior and exterior. I think that's really got it, yes. Perturb means a state of spiritual or mental agitation, whereas disturb defines a state of physical discomfort or unease. Well done. Dillis. Now, here's a very, very subtle one for you. The difference, please, between to loose and to loosen. Mm.
Loosen. You don't loosen the dogs of war. You let loose the dogs of war, don't you?
Well, that's letting loose. That's yet a third thing, which, thank God, I'm not asking you.
To loose the trick. Might be a clue.
Well, you never know, do you?
I think loose.
No.
To loose is to let them all go.
But to loose is to actually undo something, and to loosen is not quite to undo it, to make it possible for the prisoner then to, using his teeth or something or other.
Quite right.
To get out.
Perfectly right. Loosening is really halfway to loosing. Well done. Dennis, the difference, please, between to bring and to fetch.
Oh, that's difficult, isn't it? Well, you wouldn't say, if you said, fetch me my bow of burning gold,
yes,
that would imply that whoever you're saying it to starts off from here and goes there. If I say, bring me my bow of burning gold, I'm implying the person I'm instructing is already there to come here. So it's a question of where you start from.
You think fetch implies a sort of U-turn?
Implies leaving here and going there, whereas bring, I would say, means come from there to here with it.
You don't shout bring to a dog, do
no, you?
No,
you say fetch when the dog's at your side or near about.
Yes.
It's slightly more effort involved in fetch. You've got to do the double journey.
I think you're right about there being more effort, but I'm not quite sure about the double journey. I think the real thing, at least what the dictionary says, is it's ultimately a matter of distance. To bring is something that you bring from quite close to. To fetch is something you have to bring from much further away. In fact, they ought to have said, fetch back my bonnie to me.
Yes.
In this round, the teams are asked to recite, each one line at a time, some verses from a well-known poem. On this occasion, the first verse only of Ben Jonson's tribute entitled to Celia. Starting with you, Frank, will you please lead off to Celia?
Oh!
That's it?
Yes.
Got it.
Drink to me warmly with thine eyes.
Stop. Antonia.
This bit has never been sung, and I will pledge with thine.
With?
Mine, of course.
Right. Dennis.
Or leave a kiss within the cup.
And I'll not ask for wine.
I don't think no. Absolutely. But can anybody else do it?
The thirst that from the soul doth rise.
Well done, Dennis. Antonia.
Doth ask a kiss divine.
Doth ask a
kiss.
Drink divine.
Drink divine. Dillis.
But might I from of Jove's nectar suck?
Stop, Dennis.
I would not change
swap
for thine.
Well done. Dennis gets 2 marks. He got all his right. Antonia gets 1 mark because she only got some of hers right. Dennis and Frank get 1 mark each, which means 3 marks to Dennis and Antonia and 2 marks to Frank and Dennis. And now we come to the last round and Frank and Dennis's quotations. Marks awarded, as usual, on the length of the applause from the audience here in the theatre. Frank, your quotation is, "I am monarch of all I survey."
I want you to be the first to know that we've got a third kitten now in the family, which is a Burmese kitten. And, oh, tremendous, marvellous kitten. It's almost human. It's almost human in several ways. One is that it talks all the time. I had a girlfriend like that once. I was 12 at the time. Her name was Liza Dumore. And she was... I used to take her to the concert party at the Bohemia. And she used to talk all the way through it. And the other thing about my kitten is that he's shy. At the moment, he lives up the back of my sweater. I don't know why he does it. Not outside, but touch of the Richard III's, you know. He crawls up inside, and he hangs there. And at lunchtime, I have to get him out again, which is okay normally. But if I'm alone in the house, it means I have to back down the drive to the front gate. And get a cat-loving passerby to wrench him out. And I had a girlfriend like that who was shy. Her name was Monica Willoughby, and she was painfully shy. She used to, if a stranger even looked at her, her rather sallow complexion used to change and go bright scarlet. It was like taking out a traffic light. Well, my kitten was like Monica. And another thing that my human-like characteristic my kitten has is he's a lovely cream-coloured, a sort of blonde cream and peaches, really. And I had a girlfriend like that once. It was during the war, and she was a masseuse. I had an appendix out at the RAF hospital at Ringway, and she came to give me postnatal contractions. Her name was Sergeant Faye Bloater. And her one object in life was to get married. I don't know why. Sergeant Bloater had this lovely blonde hair. You know, the French have a saying, "At every parting, we die a little." I think she must have. And what she'd done was to sort of ink in, dye her parting dark. Sort of, she must have blackened it or something. Our romance was not to be, because she got a compassionate posting to Iceland. I never saw her again. And the other kind of thing my kitten has is he's very clumsy. You know how kittens race at an apple tree and run up it? My kitten races at the apple tree, and his head hits it with a thud, and he sort of staggers back. And I had a girlfriend like that once. Her name was Val Valentine. She was a burly girl, and her mother used to say, "Hand the cakes round, Val." And Val would pick up the plate of cakes and swing it round, and all the cakes would thud into the wallpaper and appear. And the plate would hit a small occasional table and crash. And our romance finished one Sunday lunch where I was invited there, and I reeled away with crackling in my hair and an earful of apple sauce and a pint and a half of gravy down my trousers. But my daughter said, you know, we must name the kitten. We really must name the kitten. And I thought, I was very worried about naming. I couldn't think of a name for it. And I thought that as this kitten has the characteristics of these four ex-girlfriends of mine, why don't I arrange their Christian names in the most euphonious order? Which is what we've done. And now very soon the kitten will sit high up and gaze down at the inferior world, and she'll have a little collar on her, and the collar will have a little name tab, and the name tab will say, "I am Monica Val Liza Fay."
Dennis, your turn. The Stars and Stripes Forever.
I don't know how you feel about fancy dress parties, but in my opinion, which I respect, as a source of pleasure, they rank somewhere on the same level as cleaning the oven. That's why last August, when a certain somewhat florid magazine publisher invited us to an opulent costume party at his legendary country house, my first impulse was to try and weasel out, which my wife couldn't understand. Oh, come on, she said, this one shouldn't present any difficulties to you, because the invitation says, come as the title of your favourite film. Well, you love films, she said. There must be hundreds of titles you could design yourself a costume for. But, as I said, my enthusiasm for any kind of dressing up cannot be understressed, which is why, as we went to the garage to get into the car on the night of the party, I was simply wearing my ordinary clothes. If questioned, I was going to claim that I was representing either the man in the grey flannel suit, or if I was in the company of my wife, the odd couple. And I say that because she'd really entered into the spirit of the thing. She'd found herself an exceedingly low-cut chiffon nightie, cut it even lower, and was going as in the heat of the night. And that's where my trouble started, because when she asked me how she looked, I suggested that an equally suitable title might be Room at the Top. Well, she didn't take that very well. In fact, she jumped into the car, slammed the door, and whizzed off to the party on her own, leaving me with a distinct feeling that A, I was now in the doghouse, and B, the only way to get out of it would be to get into something more in the nature of real fancy dress myself, which is when I realised something else. Not only had she taken the car, but she'd also taken both sets of house keys. In other words, I now had to think up a costume that could be assembled only out of whatever was to hand in the garage, which wasn't much. Hanging on the back wall were two old school raincoats the kids used to wear. Now, if I put them on, I could possibly go as the Blue Max. So alternatively, there was an old Perspex windscreen leaning against the wall. Now, suppose I cut a section out of the back of my trousers, covered the hole with a square of the transparent plastic, could I then pass myself off as one of my truly favourite films, Rear Window, or even possibly Smiling Through? But then the sight of two chamois leather washcloths reminded me of one of my all-time favourite films, Tarzan. From then on, it took me no time at all to strip right off, staple the chamois leathers together, and wrap them round myself into a sort of rudimentary jungle-type loincloth. Now, I still think that if the taxi I hailed hadn't broken down half a mile away from the country house, my wife would now be speaking to me. As it was, being forced to make the last part of the journey on foot, I decided not to court undue attention by walking along the road in such an exiguous garment, so I set off across the field, which is my second big mistake. I hadn't gone 10 yards and there was a pounding of hooves behind me. Looking over my shoulder, I saw the most wicked-looking bull I'd ever set eyes on. Well, I don't know if you ever tried to run quickly in a tight leather loincloth, but the fact is, the faster you move, the closer the loincloth constricts. In fact, I'm sure that's why the real Tarzan emitted so many of those peculiar high-pitched screams. In the end, the garment became such an impediment, I realised the only way I'd keep ahead of the bull was by whipping it off. Which was why, when at 11:50, I finally burst through the hedge onto the lawn where the fashionable gathering was assembled, I was panting, sweating, and stark naked. And of course, because they all thought that was the costume that I'd chosen, everybody was trying to guess which film I was supposed to be. I must say, some of the titles they suggested were really quite flattering, such as The Greatest Show on Earth, and Splendor in the Grass. But most of them, like The Pink Panther, were distinctly ill-mannered, particularly the incredible shrinking man, or from somebody who is obviously a veteran film goer, Wee Willie Winky. But I didn't appreciate the full extent of my humiliation till a rather keen-eyed young farmer declared that the most suitable title for me had to be Midnight Cowboy. Because, you see, the creature I'd been fleeing from didn't happen to be a bull at all. Which explains the caption which the local paper put under the flashlight photo they printed, showing me running across a field with nothing on, holding a leather loincloth and hotly pursued by a young cow. It read, "This Tarzan strips for heifer."
Well, ladies and gentlemen, according to your applause, Dennis wins the story this week, but Dillis and Frank are the overall winners. And so now, it's goodbye from Dillis Powell, Antonia Fraser, Frank Muir, and Dennis Norden.
In my word, the chairman was John Julius Norwich. The questions were compiled by Peter Moore, and the program was produced by Tony Schrein.
You've been listening to My Word from the BBC, heard each week at this time. This is the WFMT Fine Arts Network.